Thank you for attending the last of our concurrent Friday presentations. This is session 278, titled Gender, Religious Authority, and Elect Ladies, Jemima Wilkinson, Ann Lee, and Emma Smith. Before we begin, we ask that your cell phones be turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope you're taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books. Please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors. This session is 90 minutes long, and we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. After this session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger, a Utah tradition. Please return on time for our preliminary with Dr. Gregory Parents. Seats will fill up quickly. About the presentation. Gender and authority shape the roles played by Emma Smith, Ann Lee, and Jemima Wilkinson, each of whom profoundly affected her religious community. Each were called elect lady and held high positions of authority in her church. Each took issue with her community's belief regarding sexuality and marriage, each opposing her own husband or marriage itself. One would reject her female identity completely. Another would magnify her femaleness to the fullest extent possible. A third would reject polygamy and contribute to the fracturing of her church. Claire Barris is a senior systems engineer for a large company in Utah, manages Today in Mormon History, which is a great resource, by the way, on the internet, publishes in the Journal of Mormon History, and has blogged at various sites, most recently at withoutin.org. He has presented papers at the Sunstone Symposium, Mormon History Association, and the John Whitmer Historical Society. Maxine Hanks is a theologian and lecturer researching gender in religion. She has authored or co-authored several books, including Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, Mormon Faith in America, Getting Together with Yesterday, A History of San Pete County, and was a contributor to Secrets of Mary Magdalene, Religion in America, and Latter-day Descent. Joseph Geisner and his wife provide residential services for developmentally disabled adults. He has published in Sunstone, the John Whitmer Historical Journal, the Journal of Mormon History, Iriadum. Joe is an avid collector of the New Mormon History and rare collectible Mormon books. By the way, I was lucky enough to be invited to contribute to the Arrington three-volume diaries that have been recently published. If you didn't make that session yesterday, it was amazing. Get the recording for that. That is an amazing session. Just on a personal level, these two people are some of my favorite people, and I actually specifically asked Claire and Maxine if I could be a participant because I have such respect for both of them. So Claire will be first, Maxine second, and they saved the worst and the most incapable for last.
I don't know about that, Joe. Yeah, well, and Joe and Maxine, yeah, I'm honored to be on the same stage with them. So this is great. So I got to warn you before you decide to stay. I'm going to be talking about violence, sex, castration, spiritual husbands, spiritual wives, nudity, naked dancing, voyeurism, and even women being in charge of men. So brace yourselves. The United States and Great Britain were deeply steeped in patriarchy during the latter 18th and early 19th centuries. Most Christian denominations took seriously statements by the Apostle Paul that women should remain silent in religious settings and bring religious questions only to their husbands, who were considered their superiors. This repressive environment smothered nearly all female religious voices. Quakers, however, were less restrictive, believing that only that the Spirit could speak to women as well as men. This crack in the patriarchal veneer allowed two women, when prophetically moved, to rise up and outwardly declare their messages from God. In particular, when Anne Lee moved from Manchester, England, to New York State, she, along with American-born Jemima Wilkinson, would become the first two women American prophetesses, each independently called an elect lady. In 1830, after these two religious leaders had passed away, a third elect lady came onto the scene. Mormon prophet Joseph Smith declared in Revelation that his wife was an elect lady to be ordained to a prominent role in the church, foreshadowing a priesthood role for women a dozen years later. The extreme patriarchy and sexual expectations shaped for those women shaped who those women would become. All three rejected their expected sex and gender roles. So the first of the elect ladies, Jemima Wilkinson, first, and this is her first vision. In 1776, at age 18, Jemima Wilkinson claimed to have a series of visions during a serious illness and, quote, passed into the angel world, quote, unquote, where, quote, her body was reanimated by a spirit whose mission was to deliver the oracles of God to mankind, close quote. After her resurrection, as it has become known, she received a, quote, new name from the Lord, which was Universal Friend or Public Universal Friend. And she never used her original name, Jemima, again. Wilkinson's followers believed that she was, quote, Jesus Christ in the form of a woman, close quote. Some would pray to her, saying, Jemima is the Son of God, the Messiah reappeared in the flesh, that whosoever shall believe on Jemima shall be saved, but whosoever shall not believe that Jemima is Jesus Christ the Savior shall be everlastingly damned. So this is serious belief, right? The friend, as she was called, taught that celibacy was preferred and abstinence from sex as much as possible was discouraged for those who were married. Wilkinson felt she could assume religious authoritative roles only by assimilating masculinity. She thus became the first American-born woman to found a religious society, but with a compromise to her expression of gender. By at least 1778, this is about 2 years after her first vision, she began dressing in men's clothes, wearing a man's hairstyle, talking in a low voice, and acting like a man. All gendered pronouns were dropped for herself and her followers. She never allowed herself to be called a she. In addition to her original identity being subsumed by the spirit which inhabited her, so was her gender. She surrounded herself primarily with women who held the highest positions of leadership and trust. In 1790, Wilkinson and her Society of Friends, as they were called, made an exodus to the unsettled frontier of Western New York to build a, quote, New Jerusalem among the Indians. She built the largest white community in the wilderness of Western New York, naming it Jerusalem. And there is a town, Jerusalem, New York, that you can visit if you're ever back there. Wilkinson tried to remove both gender and marriage from her society, both regarded as impediments to true spirituality. One historian concluded that Wilkinson and her followers were the first religion in the United States to incorporate serious gender, extended gender fluidity, and the denial of female spiritual authority. They repudiated their gender identity in order to assume the prophetic mantle. Because only men had public religious voices in the Revolutionary era, Wilkinson claimed a male identity once her female spirit died, giving her religious authority through her new male voice. As the first American-born prophetess, Jemima Wilkinson stood alone until the Christian Science movement was founded by American-born Mary Baker Eddy in 1879. So that's the first of our elect ladies. The next one, Anne Lee. And I'm going to start talking about Shaking Quakers. Anne Lee began attending the meeting of radical Quakers James and Jane Wardley in 1758 in Manchester, England. When it came to women, the Wardleys were more progressive than traditional Quakers, with Jane acting as their primary preacher. They would sing, chant, shout, shake, and dance, all of which was thought to be therapeutic, inspiring the name Shaking Quakers. They believed that because Jesus was the eternal Father, the second coming of Christ would be in female form, the eternal mother. Anne Lee was born into a patriarchal environment of 18th century England. A woman had no legal status to vote, own property, or sign contracts, and had legal status only through her attachment to her husband or father. Due to impoverished quarters, there was little privacy for her parents in the bedroom. According to an early Shaker record, quote, "In her early youth, Anne Lee had a great abhorrence of the fleshly cohabitation of sexes, and so great was her sense of its impurity that she often admonished her mother against it, which, coming to her father's ears, he threatened and actually attempted to whip her." Lee's husband was selected by Anne's father against Anne's will. She bore four children, none of which survived past age six. Her last delivery required forceps, leaving her nearly lifeless. She was stricken with guilt, believing her loss of children was God's punishment for her sin, leading to her to a complete nervous breakdown. She was appalled by the, quote, "great depravity of human nature and the odiousness of sin, especially of impure an indecent nature of sexual coition," close quote. Her prayers for deliverance from sin reportedly caused her to perspire blood through her pores, and her cries, screeches, and groans would last through the night. Lee expressed her aversion to sex to Jane Wardley, who told her in return, quote, "James and I lodge together, but we do not touch each other. You may return and do likewise," close quote. She followed Jane's advice, avoiding the bed, quote, "as if it had been made of embers," close quote, and denied herself of every gratification of a carnal nature. First vision. Since women could not preach in churches, she began preaching in the streets, but her hysterical sermonizing got her imprisoned for disturbing the peace in 1770. Lee would be imprisoned, beaten, and sexually and physically assaulted numerous times throughout her short life. While imprisoned, quote, "the most astonishing vision and divine manifestations were presented to her in so clear and striking a manner that the whole spiritual world seemed displayed before her. She saw Adam and Eve having sex in the Garden of Eden, leading to their expulsion from the garden. From this vision, she determined that sex was at the root of humanity's woes and the reason for its separation from God. Original sin was not from taking the fruit, it was for partaking of sex. Second vision. Lee was arrested again. Notice she always has her visions in prison. Lee was arrested again and placed in a madhouse, actually not prison, this time a madhouse. And not unlike Joseph Smith, described rays of light coming over her and seeing the glories of heaven. Quote, "she saw the Lord Jesus Christ in his glory, and it was revealed that she was to be his anointed successor on earth." The second coming. The nickname for shaking Quakers would be shortened to Shakers. The official name was, quote, the United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, with Lee literally being the second appearing of Christ. Because as Lee stated, Christ through me is born a second time. So this is the, and is the second coming. Is that clear? The first coming was Jesus. The second coming is Ann Lee. Lee had a vision in 1774 that the true church was to be established in America, where religious freedom would abound. Eight believers traveled to America, setting up an isolated commune near Albany, New York. In America, Ann Lee would be called the Elect Lady. Mormon beliefs and practice resembled many of those found among Shakers. Now listen to this list carefully, and the parallels are quite striking, I believe. For example, Ann Lee's communal Zion groups sang in tongues, practiced healing, uttered revelations. Their teachings included an apostasy and a restoration of the, quote, only true and living gospel on the earth, close quote. A restoration of keys, preaching to the world of spirits, dietary restrictions forbidding coffee, tea, and meat, eternal increase, meaning eternal progression, that the American Constitution, quote, in the providence of God, was to make way for the establishment of the gospel, close quote. They believed they had, quote, entered the latter-day glory, which had long been the subject of prophecy, close quote. They also believed in preexistence, a probationary state, and in spiritual posterity. Shakers believed, quote, God is both father and mother, reflecting the dual nature of humanity. Christ needed to appear in both male and female form to fully reveal the nature of God. Ann Lee was the female Christ, the mother nature of God. So, gender and sexuality. Shakers had no gender stereotypes. Men could be tender and women powerful. The idea was rejected that women were inferior because of Adam and Eve. The fall was not because of Eve's transgression, as was commonly taught, but because of sex. Ann Lee, as the female Christ, was the de facto progenitor of the feminist movement in the United States. Lee had rejected her earthly sexuality, replacing it with a spiritual one. Quote, I have been in the fine valleys with Christ as a lover. I am married to the Lord Jesus Christ, close quote. She noted her natural desires had been replaced by, quote, the exuberant bliss of divine intercourse, close quote. Sexual tensions plagued the celibate Shaker communes. One observer noted that, quote, the Shaker spirit is magnetism mingled with sexual passion. Union meetings were held three times a week where men and women sat face to face for an hour in friendly social intercourse with each other. The rationale for this was the importance of allowing both sexes to have interaction, for if not, quote, they surely would have a carnal one. Lee constantly preached against sexuality. Quote, the most hidden abominations were often brought to light, and those secret acts of wickedness, which had been deceitfully covered under, were many times brought to view in such a manner as to make every guilty soul fear and tremble, close quote. At one point, she related a vision, not unlike the vision of Adam and Eve, about some of her previously married converts. Quote, I see a vision, a large black cloud as black as thunder clouds, and it is occasioned by men sleeping with their wives, close quote. Rumors circulated about male castration. Others were punished for sexuality. Quote, several were whipped, and some were ordered to whip themselves as mortification to the flesh. A young woman by the name of Elizabeth Cook was reportedly stripped and whipped naked by Noah Wheaton for having desires towards a young man. Shakers were the only communal society that required complete chastity while men and women lived in the same community. Dance. The purpose of dancing among Shakers was multifaceted. It provided a therapeutic release, spiritual expression, and a remedy for sexual urges. Disaffected Shaker Valentine Rathbun, that's a cool name, described Shaker worship. Quote, "They run about in the woods and elsewhere, hooting and tooting like owls, gape, stretch, and twitch as though in convulsions. They follow this violence, sudden acute weakness sets in, and worshipers fall haplessly to the floor. Some Shakers sing songs, some sing without words in Indian dialects, others sing jigs or tunes of their own making, which are called new tongues. While some dance, others jump up and down, all this going on at the same time until the different tunes, groanings, jumping, dancing, drumming, laughing, talking, fluttering, shoving, hissing, make such a bedlam as only the insane can thrive upon. This Anley calls the worship of God. Other dancing was more formalized, with men and women facing each other, although women and men never actually touched each other when dancing. One observer described the dancing Shakers, quote, swiftly passing and repassing each other as clouds agitated by a mighty wind, close quote. Another former Shaker, Thomas Brown, notes, several things which took place for the sake of modesty here are omitted. They stopped up every avenue of their houses or every window so that the world's people, as they were called, could not see them, and had one or two of the brethren out to watch. They then stripped themselves and danced naked. When the gift or order came from Mother Anne to do so, those who would not be obedient had to walk out of the room and were generally mortified by being called fleshly creatures full of the flesh. So if you wouldn't dance naked when Anne Lee ordered it, you were kind of castigated and made fun and called a fleshly creature full of the flesh. Rathbun reported, quote, some of the women Shakers strip naked in the woods, thinking that they are angels and invisible and can go about among men and not be seen. It was explained, quote, they were not naked in one sense, being clothed with spiritual garments, clothed with salvation. And Brown further notes, quote, an amusing incident was reported in which the brethren wished to dance, danced nude, which they called to rejoice, but had to desist when Anne and another sister wanted to enter the room, to which one objected. He said to her, you know, if any of the sisters are with us, we shall have a war, that is, have to fight against the rising of nature. But as she would not retire, he pushed her out and shut the door against her. Some dancing grew very ecstatic, and some who whirled would faint. Quote, some of the early New Lebanon Shakers died from excessive exertion in trying to eliminate their sexual desires. Night-long dancing, followed by sleep upon the floor, a floor of chains, ropes, sticks, and every humiliating and mortifying posture they could devise. The Albany Gazette reported Anne Lee's death in 1784, noting the passing of, quote, the elect lady or mother of Zion and head of the people called Shakers, close quote. That's our second elect lady. And now on to the third, Emma Smith. First, we'll talk about the elect lady revelation. In DNC 25, Emma is to be, quote, ordained under the Joseph's hand to expound scriptures and to exhort the church, which were also duties equivalent to those assigned to teachers and deacons at the time. Joseph Smith recalled, quote, that she was ordained at the time the revelation was given, probably to the office of elect lady. Like Wilkinson and Lee, Emma's title was was more than a passing phrase, and it carried significance to the early Mormons. One recollection of early Mormonism stated that, quote, a special revelation at this time was made Smith's wife the elect lady, daughter of God, with the high-sounding title of Electa Kyria. Electa Kyria is Greek for elect lady. Even the New York Herald noted Emma's title, Electa Kyria, a woman of superior intellect and exemplary piety. The rise of patriarchal marriage. In some ways, female authority increased in Mormonism, while in other ways it diminished. Joseph Smith's evolving religious views would take marriage and sexuality beyond society's existing patriarchal attitude. Polygamy lessened the status of women and further emphasized society's patriarchal attitudes, putting one man at the center of multiple women. Equality between a husband and wife, as could be achieved in monogamy, was simply not possible in polygamy. This set the stage for Emma's attempt to prevent the erosion of what power she had in her role as a wife. In DNC 132, we find evidence of a temporary progressive attitude towards women and sexuality within polygamy, intended to provide a sense of recompense to Emma. Section 132 refers to an earlier revelation whereby Emma was promised her own spiritual husband, Joseph Smith's first counselor, William Law. The rationale given by those who knew of the event indicated Emma felt it only fair that she have, quote, at least one man spiritually sealed up to her, close quote, because Joseph had so many wives. Quote, if he would indulge himself, she would too, reasoned Emma. According to the revelation, she would marry William Law, and Joseph would marry William's wife, Jane. William Law said the proposed marriage arrangement was not really a wife swap, but merely compensation for Emma for her grief. But it came with the condition that Emma, quote, stop her opposition to polygamy and permit him, Joseph, to enjoy his younger wives in peace, close quote. But just over 2 weeks later, DNC 132 was revealed, rescinding the plural husband offer to Emma, who was to, quote, partake not of that which I commanded you, Joseph, to offer her, close quote, and that she was, quote, to abide and cleave unto my servant Joseph and no one else, or she shall be destroyed, close quote. Within the role of marriage, it seemed that Emma might be given some compensation of lost power by having the right to obtain a single plural husband, but that right was rescinded, and her gender authority remained diminished. The addition of Mormon female religious authority. Some steps, however, enhanced matriarchal power within Mormonism, elevating the status of women through the bestowal of priesthood authority. At the same time plural marriage was unfolding in Nauvoo in 1842, Joseph declared Emma's role as elect lady fulfilled when she was elected president of the Nauvoo Female Relief Society. According to meeting minutes, the society was granted one of the keys of the priesthood. Its leaders were to be ordained, and it was to be a kingdom of priests. Some of this came to fruition through female membership in the Anointed Quorum, a priesthood group that included both men and women. Temple worship by the Quorum included endowment ritual, first and second anointings, and shared priesthood between couples, with Emma and Joseph both being anointed and ordained to the highest and holiest order of the priesthood. After Emma's death, Emma continued to fight against polygamy, particularly against Brigham Young, who was determined to preserve all of Joseph's teachings and practices. Emma did not go west with Young, but instead raised her sons to believe that rumors of their father's polygamous practices were not true. Eventually, their son, Joseph Smith III, would become the first president of the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which never accepted plural marriage. Because of her efforts, the second largest denomination of Mormonism would not practice it, and the relative gender authority in its monogamous through its monogamous marriages would remain on par with that of the greater American society. Conclusion. The new American Republic's promise of religious freedom created an environment where religious experimentation could thrive. Not only was religion open to interpretation, but all aspects of society were as well, including marriage, sexuality, and gender roles. The rise of three new religious movements produced women whose roles were considered so lofty they were given the New Testament title, Elect Lady. Jemima Wilkinson's Society of Friends, Ann Lee's United Society of Believers in Christ's Second Appearing, and Joseph Smith's Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints each reshaped the role of women in areas regarding religious authority, gender roles, and sexuality. The religious authority claimed by Jemima Wilkinson came from a male spirit called the Universal Friend who possessed her body. She rejected sexual expression, believing that celibacy brought one to a higher level and freeing women from male authority. Due to the extreme patriarchal negating view of women of the era, she completely denied her womanhood, assuming a male identity, thus sacrificing her female identity in exchange for religious authority. Anne Lee embraced celibacy because of her child trauma of witnessing her parents' sexual activity, her unwanted arranged marriage, and the loss of all her children. Her guilt evoked a vision of Adam and Eve in sexual congress and their expulsion from the Garden of Eden for that sin, thereby cementing her own anti-sex doctrine. Lee's altered gender role was also a reaction to her patriarchal culture. However, she went in the opposite direction of the Universal Friend, instead embracing and magnifying her own gender. Rather than redefining her gender to obtain religious authority, she redefined the definition of Christ to include womanhood. She became, in essence, the ultimate manifestation of a woman, a goddess incarnate, the female manifestation of God in the flesh. She herself became the second coming of Christ. Emma Smith's elect lady role increased female religious authority in Mormonism, putting her at the head of a women's organization that was to parallel the recently introduced all-male endowment ritual. Emma would be co-ordained with Joseph Smith as, in essence, the presiding couple over Mormonism's highest level of priesthood, an important event with interesting implications, but somehow lost to modern Mormonism. At the same time, the practice of polygamy diminished the authority of women within the Mormon institution of marriage. Emma's resistance to plural marriage nearly saw gains for women, but the revelation opening the way for women to have plural husbands would soon be rescinded. However, her continued resistance did lead to the rejection of plural marriage by the second largest Latter-day Saint denomination. Emma continuously fought to prevent the further erosion of her and emblematically her gender's relative power within marriage. The stories of these three elect ladies from the earliest decades of the American Republic demonstrate their dissatisfaction with patriarchy as each woman in her own way rebelled against the established gender roles they were expected to live as they rose in religious authority. Each strove for a more equal status within the context of the 1770s to 1840s. Thank you.
Oh, I can't move that? Okay. Should I set this on top of it?
Yeah.
Or is that going to hurt it?
No. You can set your
bench. Okay. See if I can work this out now and turn this so that I can be heard. I don't know. close enough. Okay, I think that's good. Okay, yeah, thanks. I have to say that these two guys are two of my favorite people on the planet. Okay, I'm going to stand closer. So Joe Geisner's comment is very, his sentiments are very mutual. I love these two guys. They're like brothers to me. So, you know, the term elect lady is something that we're familiar with. We've heard this for a long time, but do we really know what it means? We know about it. We hear it. It's right there in the DNC. And it's one of the most neglected, overlooked, amazing, radical, revolutionary terms in all of Mormonism, particularly Mormon origins. What is the elect lady? So I'm gonna ask some key questions and then kind of unpack the term and the concept to kind of examine it and kind of do some reinterpretation. What is the elect lady, and why did Joseph Smith invoke or use that term? And where did he get it? And what does it mean? The first time it appears is in the Doctrine and Covenants, actually not in the Doctrine and Covenants, in the book of Revelations, as Commandment 27 is where it first appears, in 1830, July 1830. And it appears, or it's referenced again 12 years later in 1842 in the Relief Society Minutes and Meeting. So where did this come from? Why does Joseph invoke that term in DNC, what we call now DNC 25? Did Joseph Smith perhaps get it from these other two women that Claire's just talked about, Jemima Wilkinson and Mother Ann Lee? Joseph could have known that they were referred to as elect lady because Joseph was extremely familiar with other religious leaders of the time, and he references them in his writings and in his speech, like the Millerites and Alexander Campbell. He refers to the other major religious leaders of his time. So he could have known it. But I don't think that he borrowed it from them. I think there's ample evidence, especially in the Relief Society Minutes, that Joseph Smith, who was utterly grounded in biblical texts, the Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and in interpreting those texts, that he got the term from the New Testament, 2 John, where in that letter of the New Testament, John addresses, the salutation at the beginning of the text of 2 John says, the elder to the elect lady. Well, I think that was just too delicious for Joseph to overlook because it has strong parallels to his relationship with Emma that crop up. Joseph tended to personalize and to find himself in biblical texts, the Old Testament and the New Testament and the Book of Mormon. Joseph identifies with them. And there's an interesting parallel between that salutation in 2 John, the elder to the elect lady, with DNC 24 and 25, which is about the leading elders or the first and second elder and then the elect lady. There's a nice parallel there. So let's go to the next question. Why? That answers sort of where it came from. It pretty clearly came from his reading of the New Testament, 2 John. But why? Why does he use it? To answer that, we have to look at the actual texts. So we want to look at two texts. We want to look at DNC 25, the Elect Lady Revelation, and we want to look at the minutes of the Relief Society, where it's referenced again. In DNC 25, also known as the 27th Commandment, in the first version of it as it appears, there, I'm going to read through it really quickly and highlight a few terms that crop up. It says, a revelation I give unto you concerning my will. Behold, thy sins are forgiven thee, and thou art an elect lady, whom I have called. And the office of thy calling shall be for a comfort to thy servant, my servant Joseph Smith. Thou shalt go with him at the time of his going and be unto him a scribe that I may send Oliver wheresoever I will. And thou shalt be ordained under his hand to expound scriptures and exhort the church according as it shall be given thee by my spirit. For he shall lay his hands upon thee and thou shalt receive the Holy Ghost. And thy time shall be given to writing and learning, and thy husband shall support thee from the church, for unto them is thy, the first version says, unto them is thy calling. The later version is changed, unto them is his calling. But in Revelation 27, it says, unto them, the church, is thy calling. Emma's calling is unto the church. Interesting editorial change, isn't it? And it shall be given to thee to make a selection of sacred hymns. And then he goes on and talks about that, which I'm going to skip down. And a crown of righteousness thou shalt receive. And verily I say unto you, this is my voice unto all. Even so, amen. Wow. Do we really digest what section 25 is saying to us? I'm going to try to unpack it a little bit here. Really quick, I'm going to skip to 1842, the Relief Society Minutes, and do just a textual comparison, and then I'm going to come back and unpack both of them. In 1842, at that first meetings of the Relief Society, Joseph Smith invokes DNC 25 because he is officially approving the Relief Society as an official authoritative body with an official leader and president and keys and priesthood and offices and ordinations. The Relief Society is all those things. So he references, as he's getting ready to sort of authorize the Relief Society with all of this authority, he connects back to DNC 25. March 17, 1842, Eliza R. Snow records that President Smith read the revelation to Emma Smith from the Book of Doctrine and Covenants and stated that she was ordained at the time the revelation was given to expound the scriptures to all and to teach the female part of the community, which is interesting because it sort of implies that, but doesn't really say that in DNC 25. He's kind of adding that now as a further interpretation of what he meant in DNC 25. And that not she alone, but others may attain to the same blessings. Wow, okay. So he's clarifying what he was doing back in 1830 in section 25. Then, it says next in the Relief Society Minutes, the second epistle of John, first verse, was then read to show that respect was then had to the same thing. And that was why she was called an elect lady, is because she was elected to preside. So he directly links it to 2 John, that he's using the term from 2 John specifically, because he not only likes the elect lady, he likes the term elect. He's giving that another meaning too. Then he laid his hands on the head of Mrs. Smith and blessed her and confirmed upon her all the blessings which have been conferred upon her. Whoa. Okay, we're doing some hair splitting here. Blessed her, laid his hands, blessed her, confirmed upon her blessings which had been earlier conferred. So we've got some different layers of kind of conferrals. Necessary for her to stand and preside and dignify her office and to teach the females. So at this point, we've got all of the imagery and power and authority from DNC 25 in 1830, but we've also got some added authority and development about leading all the females and teaching all the females, which is really interesting. So there's this link, 14 years apart, and it's a good example of how Joseph Smith's innovations and revelations build and evolve and grow over the years, and yet they're still connected. And he kind of does this time warp thing, this kind of quantum, I don't know, dance from time to time, where he's kind of scaling back and forward and through time and keeping what he had before, but building on it, but changing it a little bit. That's very typical, actually. What's interesting is the office of elect lady in 1830 is different from Relief Society president. Those are two different offices of the church. Elect lady and Relief Society president. I'm going to unpack that a little bit. But in 1842, he combines them, which is interesting. And he's saying that there was only one ordination needed, which is kind of interesting. Two different offices, one ordination. Well, that raises more questions than it answers. What is that ordination? And what are those offices? I would say the elect lady, which occurs before there's any priesthood, before there's any conferral of Melchizedek or Aaronic priesthood or offices. In 1830, elect lady is an office of the lay church. It's a lay office. It's a ministry office. It's also a female office. It's not a male office, because Joseph and Oliver were the first and second elder. They weren't the elect elders. They were the first and second elder, and Emma is the elect lady. So it's a female office. It also happens to be the highest female office of the church. Is it a woman's priesthood? That's kind of an interesting question to think about. I would say no and yes, because the elect lady is a different female authority than male. It's a different female office. And the Relief Society and the Relief Society president is a different female office than male. And in fact, the Relief Society is a female order parallel to the male orders. But in some ways, it's kind of not a female priesthood, because the Relief Society has not yet been conceived in 1830. There is no female order. There is just the lay order of the church. So it's a female office in the order of disciples, or the lay order of the church. And it's anticipating a female priesthood, but we don't really have a male or a female priesthood yet. Those are going to start coming between 1831 and 33, even a female priesthood, which I talk about in a different paper I'm not going to talk about today. Okay, what was Joseph's intent? What was his purpose for doing this? Why is he coming up with a female office? Why can't everybody just be deacons, you know, and teachers and priests? Why does he need a female office in 1830 different? I'm going to unpack these revelations a little bit. I would say two key reasons. And the first one is he's trying to elevate and name women's status in the church. And the second reason is he's trying to give women equality with men in the church. And yes, I mean to say equality. He's intentionally trying to give them equality. So you've got these two things. He's trying to recognize and elevate women's status, but he's also trying to give them equality. And I'm going to mention just a few reasons why I say this. I'm going to try to rip through this because I've got way more material than I've got time to present. In 1830, Section 25 is one of the earliest revelations of the church. It's only 3 months after the church has been organized. Very early, very foundational revelation and text of the church. It's the only revelation addressed solely to a woman. It's not the beginning of Emma's authority. It's acknowledging her authority, which already existed from the time Joseph saw her in a seer stone, letting him know that she was the right one to replace Alvin and help him get the plates. She's the one who he has to wait 4 years before he gets the right one so he can finally get the plates. He can't get the plates without Emma. That's a pretty serious kind of authority that she's got. She's also a kind of witness of the plates, along with Lucy and Mary. They witness the gold plates indirectly, not directly, but there are three women witnesses who are not formal, but informal witnesses. She's a co-founder of the faith. She's the first scribe of the Book of Mormon, which is a sacred office. Scribe. She has spiritual gifts. She's promised the fullness of spiritual gifts, revelation, tongues, prophecy, healing, blessing. All of it. She's called to expound, exhort, teach, preach. She's the first hymnist. She's called by God to compile a hymn book, which is kind of a book of sacred texts. It's kind of like a book of scripture. So those are just some examples of how Joseph is elevating the status of women through Emma and also through her office. I think it's fascinating that she receives this office and this authority 3 months after the church is organized. That, like I said, it clearly indicates that she's a major figure in the founding of the church. And I'm going to unpack that a little more in a minute, too. He's also trying to give women equality with men, both ungendered, integrated, inclusive equality that is not differentiated at all, that is exactly the same, and also gendered, differentiated authority. Joseph is not lapsing into an either or, one or the other. He's not saying women and men are all going to have the same authority, and he's not saying women and men are all going to have different authority and nothing's the same. He's doing both. And this is one of the most powerful features of Mormonism that is overlooked. It's a both-and religion for women and feminists theologians. Women have the same authority men have in some ways, and they have different authority than men have in other ways. And it's an amazing balance of difference and equality. One example of that is, so I'm kind of talking about integrated versus parallel different. One example is that women were ordained like men, and the word ordained was used, and the same practice was used, laying out of hands and conferral of authority. And they're ordained to a number of the same offices, including preaching the gospel. Eloisa Barnes Pratt in 1850, ordained by Brigham Young to preach the gospel. They're also ordained to teach, lead, exhort, expound, all the things in section 25. But they're not ordained to male offices in either the lay ministry or the male priesthoods. And that's where it gets interesting. Men and women are both ordained, same process, a lot of the same duties, callings. But when it comes to priesthood and offices, they're different. They're gendered. It's a nice both and. Also, I want to touch on a really important consideration of the Elect Lady Revelation. You have to see it in context with section 24 and 26. It's a trinity. 24, 25, and 26 are the three revelations received in July of 1830. All together, they're all connected, they reflect, very reflexive. So you can't look at 25 apart from 24 and 26. And you also have to look at section 20 in connection. They all work together. Because section 20 clearly establishes Joseph Smith as the first elder of the church and Oliver as the second elder of the church ordained under his hand. So that gives the names of their offices, just like the name Elect Lady. Section 24 outlines the duties and authority of Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery as the first and second elder of the church. And guess what? They are so parallel with the language and the duties and the offices in section 25 for Emma Smith as the Elect Lady that they're almost identical, which again supports the interpretation that I make that these are offices of the lay church before we get into priesthood, before we even start talking about Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood. These are offices of the lay church. Very parallel. Section 24, I'll just use a few of the words and think back to what section 25 says. Section 24 says, a revelation to Joseph and Oliver concerning their calls, called and chosen to write, and to my ministry, magnify thine office. The church shall support thee. You'll be writing the things which shall be given thee by the Comforter. Thou shalt expound all scriptures unto the church. Speak and write whatever shall be given thee. Devote thy service, be patient in afflictions. And this is to all those also whom thou hast ordained. Okay, all of those terms I pulled out are nearly identical or the same to what is given to Emma in section 25. So we have this really interesting parallel, which indicates that the ordination in 1830, which it is, it's an ordination. Women are ordained in 1830. Emma is ordained. Is very, very much the same as men's ordination. Neither women nor men are being ordained to Melchizedek or Aaronic priesthood. It's the lay ministry. It's church offices. And they're given a lot of the same duties and authorities. So there's a tremendous aspect of ungendered ordination happening. But there's one distinction. First and second elder, Elect Lady. There's just a distinction in the office. In section 26, this gets interesting too. The third, so section 24 outlines, you know, the men's authority. Section 25 is Emma's authority. Section 26 gives men and women the vote in the church. Thanks. I asked Joe to warn me when I've been talking 20 minutes, so I'm going to have to hurry. It's fascinating to think that women get the vote in Mormon culture when they can't vote or do anything legal or serve as witnesses outside of the church, outside of Mormonism in American society. It says no person can be ordained to any office in the church without the vote of the church. And all things are done by common consent in the church. The members all vote. So those are important considerations for unpacking the elect lady and what she is and what she can do. Another thing I want to bring up is Emma's confirmation and ordination. Section 25, this revelation happens right between Emma's baptism and her confirmation. She's baptized in June. She's confirmed in August, we think, early August. But right after she's baptized, Joseph is kidnapped, pulled away by a mob, and it takes him quite a while to get back. And when he comes back in July, he gives Emma this blessing to comfort her. But the blessing has the language of a confirmation. It's foretelling that she's going to be confirmed. But it also talks about her ordination. It says, he will lay hands on you and you will be ordained. But then what it describes is her confirmation. So there's a kind of, it raises an important theological question because it kind of conflates her ordination with her confirmation, which again supports my interpretation of ordination to the lay ministry of the church. It suggests that when we are confirmed, because the Revelation says, what I say to you, I say to all, when we are confirmed and they lay hands upon us and confirm, the terms Joseph uses in the DNC, the Holy Ghost, the Spirit upon us who will teach us all things, that confirmation is so similar to what he's doing in section 25, it suggests that our confirmation is an ordination to the lay ministry, which gives us a lot to think about. If every member of the church is confirmed, and if DNC 25, those promises are for all, then everyone who's confirmed is a lay minister, is ordained a lay minister. Okay, so the elect lady, last of all, what does it mean? What does it mean, elect lady? I've kind of covered some of that. I'm going to kind of skip down and try to... one thing I want to mention really quickly is that when you look at the language of 24 and 25 and 20 and the terms leading elder, first and second elder, and elect lady, what you have is a kind of first presidency of the church. Because they are the three highest ranking leaders of the lay church in July of 1830. What you also have a little later on that gets really interesting is that Joseph is quite often comparing himself to Moses, or I should say the revelations of God to Joseph are comparing Joseph to Moses. Sorry about that. Hope I didn't offend anybody. Joseph's voice, right? Voice. He's often compared to Moses, and Oliver is compared to Aaron. DNC 8, Oliver is compared to Aaron. DNC 28, Joseph is compared to Moses. And what's interesting about that is that in DNC 28, the reason that Joseph is compared to Moses is because of the Hiram Page conflict over who can be a seer and whose revelations are official. And what's interesting about that is in section 28, the revelation Joseph gets to settle the controversy between Hiram Page's revelations and his seer stone and Joseph's, you know, because this is the early church and, you know, we're all seers and we're all revelators, right? But wait a second, whose revelations, like, over, you know, reign over others? Joseph Smith appeals to the story in the Old Testament of Moses and Aaron. And God telling Moses and Aaron and Miriam that there's a difference between Moses' authority as a prophet and Aaron and Miriam's authority as prophets. This text in DNC 28 says, you know, Oliver, you can teach by the Comforter, but no one will be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church excepting my servant Joseph Smith, for he receiveth them even as Moses. And thou shalt be obedient unto the things which I shall give to him, even as Aaron. So he's directly comparing the authority of Moses and Aaron, which links right back to the Old Testament, Numbers 12, 1 through 8, where Moses and Aaron and Miriam are all called into the tent by God. All three of them are prophets, but Aaron and Miriam are contesting Moses' authority over them. And God calls all three of them into the tent and talks to all three of them because they are the three prophets who lead Israel
Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. And there are numerous references to that, that all three of them lead. And he distinguishes the authority of Moses from that of Aaron and Miriam. Aaron and Miriam say, "Has the Lord spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tent of the meeting." So the three came out, and the Lord called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward, and he said, "Hear my words. When there are prophets among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to them in visions, and I speak to them in dreams. Not so with my servant Moses. He is entrusted with all my house, and with him I speak face to face, clearly, not in riddles, and he beholds the form of the Lord." I think Joseph Smith intentionally references that text when he's settling the controversy between him and Hiram Page. The very interesting implication of that is that Emma is in the Miriam role. Okay, I've probably got, what, 5 minutes? What, 2 minutes. Okay, I'm going to hurry in. Real quickly, I'm going to touch on the notion of elect lady in the New Testament. Because Joseph is using 2 John for this concept, it needs to be asked, and this is kind of where I'll end, it needs to be asked, what did John in the New Testament mean by elect lady? Who was he referring to? And really quickly, I'll just summarize. New Testament scholarship and the text itself clearly indicates that you have three kinds of salutations in the New Testament. The books begin with a salutation to an important person or a particular role or office, someone with a particular role or office, or they're a salutation to the church as a whole. Traditionally, the elect lady was interpreted when 2 John says, "The elder to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth," that's been interpreted to mean John is speaking to the church, and the elect lady is a metaphor for the church and for the members. But that's not the case. That's not the case. It's one possible interpretation, but as you unpack it and look at it more deeply, there are all kinds of examples in not only in 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John that would refute that, but also in other references to women and salutations to women and the female imagery used in the New Testament, which would indicate that there's another interpretation there. The elect lady may not be a metaphor for the church. He may have been addressing either a real woman who had a high-ranking role of leadership in the church and her house church, her congregation, which is how I interpret it, or that he was referring to a general kind of office. So either way, it could be both, but I lean toward the interpretation that he's addressing a female leader of a house, early house church. And I don't have time to unpack all the evidence for that. I'm going to end there. But I just want to say that two quick things. I think it's fascinating that Joseph Smith picked a literal interpretation of 2 John, the elect lady, rather than a metaphorical one, because the most recent feminist scholarship agrees with him. The other thing I want to say is, and again, Claire mentioned some of this, but it's amazing when you look at the timeline of women who were ordained or were allowed to be ministers and when that begins in America and where Joseph Smith's elevation and acknowledgement of women's authority as elect lady and as preaching and leading. When you look at the timeline, there are very few examples of women having anything whatsoever like what Mormon women and what Emma gets. They come in very, very, very early. And I don't have time to go over that, but I just wanted to leave that with you. And that's it. Thanks.
Again, I'd like to thank both Claire and Maxine for their wonderful papers. I encourage Claire to look at other women who held the title Elect Lady a few years ago. And I think he has done a fine job of fleshing this history out for all of us to learn from his research. In fact, Claire's paper is being published by the John Whitmer Historical Journal this fall. It's a longer version of this. I'd first like to do a little survey of the title Elect Lady. As Maxine and Claire both pointed out, it's found in Second John 1:1. And I appreciate Maxine fleshing those details out about that and also the tie-in with the Relief Society minutes and Joseph Smith's discussion of that there. The next would be Joseph Smith III in February 1870 in the True Latter-day Saints Herald. He wrote an article called The Elect Lady. His cousin, Inez Smith Davis, wrote The Elect Lady, the True Saint, and also in the True Saints Herald, and that was in November 1915. An RLDS scholar, or I shouldn't say that, a person in the RLDS tradition, Margaret Wilson Gibson, wrote Emma Smith, The Elect Lady, in Independence, published in Independence, Missouri Herald House, 1966. Ivan Barrett, a BYU professor, wrote Emma Smith, The Elect Lady, in a extension publication, BYU extension publication, in 1966. Val and Avery and Linda Newell, in September 1979, Ensign, wrote The Elect Lady, Emma Hale Smith. They also then published Mormon Enigma, which discusses the Elect Lady 11 different times. Carol Cornwall Madsen spoke on the Elect Lady Revelation at the Sperry Symposium in 2004. Reed Durham's Is There No Help, a paper that he presented as president of the Mormon History Association, Nauvoo, in 1974, said this: the second type of unorthodox female masonry was known as adoptive masonry. It was a separate entity. It says, in this order, the highest woman was called the Elect Lady, a striking parallel to Emma Smith's title in the Mormon highest order for women. The ceremonies for women in this order were quite similar to those later found within the endowment ceremony of the Mormons. I was going to read the ceremony, but I thought I'd better not. That paper was never published because of the controversy surrounding things like that. Cheryl Bruno, in a 2008 blog post, mentions this and gives six reasons for calling Emma Smith as an Elect Lady, one of them being this masonry tie-in. Claire posted a blog. What year did you do your blog post on it? Do you remember?
Probably maybe last year.
Okay, so it was a year ago or so. Okay. Claire has given us insights into the lives of these three interesting and accomplished women. They each sought to bring God and salvation to people, along with charitable works. Each are people that we can look to as good, accomplished, and made a difference in the world where women were not allowed to be independent. I also think Claire has done a real service in reminding us about these women. I imagine some of you have not even heard of one of these women, possibly two of them. That Claire is teaching us about these women and their accomplishments is what history should be doing in a conference like this. Claire's speech gives us a glimpse into how close these American religions were geographically, theologically, and ideologically, which couple of notes I just wrote as I was re-listening to Claire's is on YouTube there's actually the Shaker dance that Claire talks about and that I'm actually going to mention again. Christina Rossetti was telling me this a few days ago, and she's learned it and she can actually perform it. Maybe we can get her to do it in the nude. I don't know. Mormons in Ohio also covered their windows during sacrament meeting. And Edie Howe in Mormonism Unveiled discusses that, and it created quite a mystery for the outsiders. Just tell a personal experience I had a number of years ago. I was I became friends with many of the farms people, and one in particular, in a discussion, we were discussing prayer circles. My friend, the farms person, was praising the work of Frederick Huchel of Logan, Utah, who has written for farms, and Margaret Barker, a British Methodist preacher and biblical scholar. Both of these folks argue that Smith restored the ancient ring dance of the early Christians. I argued that it was much more likely Smith was familiar with prayer circles in his magic dabbling. And one of the examples of a prayer circle is in Francis Barrett's work on the occult, which was published in 1801, also in Masonry, a revelation of Freemasonry in 1828, and William Morgan's, who Joseph Smith ended up marrying, Morgan's widow, also talks about prayer circles in the Masonry. Let's speculate that Smith may have had his pearl wife even teach him that Masonic prayer circle. So let's go back to the sources, though. An itinerant preacher named Levi Hathaway, who preached in upstate New York, so in Joseph Smith's backyard in 1870, says, or wrote, "We appointed to meet with the brethren to converse on the order of the house of God. Several of the brethren believed in duty to unite as a church, that they might enjoy the ordinances of the house. There were 11. They came forward, joined hands in a ring, and joined in a prayer. This was a solemn time, and the Lord began a gracious work in that place, and there were soon about 40 added to the little band." Ethan Smith, who wrote View of the Hebrews, wrote about a women's group. "In times of declension and danger to the people of God, good women may unite and strengthen each other's hands in special prayer. Prayer in their closets and in female circles." Or my favorite, that Claire quoted, was the Shaker Dance, where Ann Lee and her friend are trying to go through the door into the dance, the ring dance, and possibly have a rise of nature. The importance of Claire's paper is that I also agree with Maxine, and I think Claire does too. Joseph Smith got this from the New Testament. In my head, it's pretty clear that that's what he did. But at the same time, to look at what was going on during this period of time, and that these kinds of things, prayer circles, elect lady, there's so many more that Joseph Smith did and that others did. New name that Claire mentions, you know. So I think that's essential and beautiful that Claire has brought that about. In my research for this, I happened to discover another elect lady. And I'll be sharing this, obviously, with all of you, plus Claire. As I was doing this research and talking with a friend of mine, he mentioned that he had once heard that Robert Matthews, the man, and he was also a murderer, convicted murderer, and a prophet who met with Joseph Smith in Kirtland, that one of his wives he called the elect lady. Unfortunately, I could never find a source for that. But the person that is, there is source, and that it is confirmed, on at least in my head and in searching it out, her name is Selina Hastings. She was the Countess of Huntingdon. She was an English religious leader that played a prominent part in the religious revival of the 18th century. And she was part of the Methodist movement in England and Wales. In 1746, Selina Hastings became the elect lady for this new movement in Methodism. Claire talks about in his longer paper, I don't know if you mentioned it today, that there is a Methodist tie-in with all of this stuff going on. It's interesting that both Jemima Wilkinson and Ann Lee come from the Quaker tradition, which is much more accepting of women during that period of time. But again, these tie-ins. They're there. They're all over. We now can open it up to questions. Speaking of that, the microphone right there, we'd ask you to speak into that microphone so that it can be recorded.
This question is for Claire. Often there's a criticism that if you have hostile sources, people who have left a particular organization don't always, that sometimes they embellish or make look worse what was going on in the organization they used to belong to. Did you find sources that were still loyal to the Shakers that had to do with some of the more salacious claims about dancing that confirmed that, or the ones that had the most wild claims about what was going on during the dances, were those all former Shakers?
Yeah, that's a good point, and they were former Shakers. They did collaborate each other, so that helps bolster that idea. But the Shakers would not reveal to the outsiders the kinds of things that were going on. So that must be taken with somewhat of a grain of salt, but there are at least two who confirm that sort of salaciousness going on.
I would actually just disagree a little bit with Claire on that, because outsiders actually did report some of that stuff going on too with the Shakers. So there were outsiders who were completely independent of being former members.
Right, yeah. Insiders who remained inside did not report that. No. But yeah, outsiders and former Shakers, yes. Thanks, Joe.
So first that I want to say to Claire, I just have a small pedantic critique that may seem very trifling, but I do think that it's important in increasing accessibility of Mormon history. And if your paper hasn't been published yet, I'd encourage you to consider this edit. Anytime talking about Jemima Wilkinson, she is often held up, is often held up as this champion in the LGBTQ community, as somebody who is an early adopter of a non-binary person. And was very out and vocal about it. So I would encourage you to, prior to their conversion, their 18, when they turned 18 and had this conversion, refer to them as she, and then after, I would recommend they. But even their biographer in 2005, I want to say, by the name of Brown, even that biographer used he frequently, which is just, it shows a little insensitivity to the community. So that's just one thing that I want to say. And my second point that I'd like to bring up, this is more for Maxine. I think it might be a good idea to maybe temper our idea of Joseph's progressivism by looking at what he conceptualized the role of Relief Society of in its earliest formative stages. In his sermons that he preached there in March and April of 1842. And I'm thinking specifically of the sermon that he gave in April 1842, April 15th. I'm pulling that off the top of my head, where he specifically derided Jemima Wilkinson and Joanna Southcott as female leaders of congregations. And he goes on to postulate this argument that there was a man that was part of Joanna Southcott's congregation, I believe, and he was killed or he ran into some misfortune. And then Joseph went on to quote the Romans passage from Paul saying that women's role in the church is to be silent and ask their husbands after they get home. And that the reason that this man ran into misfortune was because these women were the heads of the congregation. So I think that possibly exhibits that even Joseph didn't know what the role of the Relief Society was and the Elect Lady when the society was formed, and keeping that in mind. And also it took him 12 years within his ministry, after his ministry was started, to even consider that women have a role in the church. That seems a little bit tone deaf, even though he was quite cognizant of these other female preachers and heads of churches at his time, day and age. So I think it's understandable that we should just view Joseph Smith as a product of his culture. He wasn't this amazing progressive above and beyond every one of his contemporaries, but he was still a product of 19th century America. So please respond. I know there's not a question. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I appreciate the critique and the idea of what pronoun to use to refer to Jemima, and that's a good question. And there is the question: was she what was her orientation, and what was her? And I do discuss that in a longer paper. I do a little hypothetical looking at that. Most of her closest people were women, and women lived with her exclusively in her mansion house in Jerusalem, and those were the ones she was closest to. But we can't say much about her her orientation and her gender, as well as her gender set. It's all kind of speculative because we don't have anything concrete. But I appreciate your what you've said, and I'm going to give that some thought. Thank you.
Although it's kind of hearkening to the sin of presentism to project today's PC language back onto, you know, I'd call that presentism. There's overwhelming evidence that Joseph Smith was radically innovative and radically deconstructive and empowering of women. You have a mixed bag. You have both. You have Joseph making really innovative changes that are intentionally, radically progressive. And then you also have him falling back at times on other statements that are typical of his time. I would not say he's typical of his time, though. I would say he's a man nearly, you know, out of his time. Also, he doesn't wait 12 years, and he doesn't define the Relief Society. I have three other papers along these lines that go into these things far more deeply. There's a very consistent pattern of Joseph Smith letting women define their own spirituality and their own order. He doesn't invent the Relief Society. The women, it comes from the women themselves in relation to building the Kirtland Temple in the 1830s. That's where the Society of Sisters is born, as a kind of women's order of the temple. And then they, after all of the going through the hell of Missouri and Zion's cabinet, when they end up in Nauvoo, the sisters reconvene it. And at that point, it's formalized. And he even says, you know, I've been thinking about this for years, and I haven't had time to really formalize this, but now it's time. So there's abundant evidence. And I am not someone who's interested in projecting any version of presentist priesthood, feminism, or church authority back onto the past. I am specifically looking at the texts of the time, and that's why I focus on that period between 1830 and 1845, because I want to get way back before Brigham Young takes over and changes everything. I mean, not everything, but he changes a lot. So I would really have to, I mean, I appreciate your caution, but I, as a historian and a feminist theorist, a gender studies person and a women's historian, believe me, I've spent 30 years probing all of that, and I could talk for hours about the innovations and the radicalism of what Joseph is doing. But it's the women who, every major innovation, the women come up with themselves. He formalizes it. He puts his stamp and says, hey, okay, this is, let's formally include this as part of the church. I didn't even get to the part where he establishes, he talks about the Relief Society and the minutes as the law and constitution of the Relief Society, and he's basically comparing them to the early versions of the Doctrine and Covenants. It's like a female Doctrine and Covenants, and that he talks about them as a living constitution, that both the presidency and the minutes are a living constitution. Well, he then borrows that term and applies it to the Council of 50, but he uses it for the Relief Society first. So, and in fact, I can thank my friend Joe Geisner for helping me locate that source in the new published version of the Council of 50 Minutes. But, I mean, I could go on and on and on. He is extremely progressive and shattering. And just looking at the timeline alone, which I didn't get time to, of women's innovations in religion in America and how Mormon women compare to that, Mormon women blow them out of the water.
That's just the tip of the iceberg.
I've got a question about the Masonic side of it, and maybe just to elaborate on that, because I'm sure I'm oversimplified, but in my mind, you've got this lay ministry, kind of an early version of the church that had, it's where it launched, and then kind of a quiet period where you've got male priesthood being developed, ecclesiastical priesthood, and then a big change happened with Joseph Smith when he inaugurated the temple endowment, influenced by the Masonic piece, and so the Masonic ritual. And so I'm wondering about elect lady returning in a new form. He didn't. It was an idea that he didn't articulate and go with, maybe because just the exigencies of life then, of to keep going. You know, the women were so busy. But then he was raised again, and then that's where the new theology happened. If you want to comment on that.
I'm dying to comment on that. Thank you for saying that, because that was the rest of my paper that I didn't have time to do. You just identified the three stages or levels of ministerial authority in Mormonism. The first stage is the 1830 to 33, the lay ministry, the lay Christian ministry, before he's developing Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood formally. The second stage, and so men and women are both in that first stage. Then it builds, and it's all related to the temple, building the Kirtland temple, and the washings and anointings of men and those rituals. And the temple itself is an Old Testament feature that he's bringing back. Which, of course, David Whitmer criticizes him for, as somehow having departed from Christian supersessionism. I'm with Joseph, not with David Whitmer. I'm really proud of Joseph for actually reconnecting the Hebraic Jewish tradition, the Old Testament with the New, which is closer in his own Christianized American way to the Jesus and John movement. But anyway, so that first stage is very much a lay Christian New Testament thing. And then he brings in the Old Testament features, the temple, Melchizedek, and Aaronic priesthood. Well, at that same time, so this is the second stage, and we get the development of Aaronic and Melchizedek priesthood, and we see this society of sisters forming around the temple, like an ancient female women's order of the temple, very, very similar to what women in First Temple and Second Temple Judaism were doing. In the women's court, the women's area, they were weaving veils and clothing and making the interiors. And Joseph, brilliant hermeneut and biblical interpreter that he is, when that's happening, he compares the women working on the Kirtland Temple to Mary Magdalene. And he says, the sisters are always the first in all good things. And just as Mary Magdalene was the first to see the risen Lord, the sisters are the first to create the interiors of the temple. I've slightly paraphrased that, but it's almost verbatim. So he links them to this ancient female order. So you have this female ancient order that's emerging unconsciously. It doesn't come from Joseph. It's coming from the women themselves. And then the men are doing the same thing. And so the second stage is the emergence of that Old Testament ancient authority for men and women. And then it gets named in Nauvoo and formalized with the Relief Society when they reconvene as another women's order of the temple when they're building the Nauvoo temple. And they go, they do the same things they did with Kirtland, but even more. They're making the garments and robes then. And then the third stage or level is the temple order, which is different. It's different from the Relief Society and the male quorums. Even though they come in, the Relief Society and the male quorums are preparatory to the temple, but when he institutes the temple ceremony, the two orders are brought together, the female order of Relief Society, which he calls a beautiful order, the beautiful order of women, through which was necessary, or the church, the restoration couldn't be complete until that came in. So he brings these two orders, the male order and female order, together in the temple, integrates them into a whole new order, the holy order or anointed quorum. And so you have a third stage or level of ministerial authority. And it's a whole new order. It's an integrated, inclusive male-female order. And I could talk more about that, but I won't. But thanks for your brilliant question.
I'd like to thank all of you for attending. Thank you very much.